good to collect things, Anatole France once said, but it is better to go on walks. But what if you could collect things and then go on walks listening to them? Didn't think about that, did you, Anatole? Hello, and welcome to Big Mouth, where we sift through the good stuff in music, TV, movies and other things and try to make sense of them. My name's Andrew Harrison, and I'm joined as usual by Sian Pattenden, the sensible June Whitfield, to my incompetent Terry Scott. Hello, Sian, how are you?
I'm very well. I'm very, very sensible today.
You are very sensible. Yep. What's better, walks or collecting?
Walks.
Walks to collect things.
Walks to collect things and then scatter them as you walk back, as if to sort of leave a trail for pigeons or children or something exciting.
Well, I went out to get a pint of milk on Sunday and I came home with two volumes of James Brown's Funky People and a Salso Orchestra compilation. So there you go. And no pint of milk. So that's actually my
idea. You can't put funk in your tea.
You can. In fact, there's probably a Maceo and the Max B-side called I've Got to Get Some Funk in My Tea. Brackets part two. Close brackets. You heard him there. It's a one guest week this week, isn't it, for a change, Sian?
Yes, it is. Poor old Steve Yates of the Word magazine has been struck down with a cold. I went to take the bins out, actually, and not only got a thimble collection, but a random Boris Johnson in quotes anthology. And so the spotlight falls on our guest, Michael Hogan, TV writer for The Guardian and Telegraph, one-time editor of Sky magazine, and veteran of loads of magazines, from Just 17 to what else have you been working for?
Zoo, More.
Was Zoo a magazine about zoos?
No.
Is that one that had ladies on it?
I wouldn't have read that. It didn't have ladies on it when I started, but I can then the ladies while I wasn't looking.
Michael lives in the metropolitan. Michael lives in the metropolitan elite enclave. You've written that so difficult.
You don't have to say it if you don't want to.
Michael lives in Stoke Newington, where even the bin men have book contracts, and the book contracts probably have book contracts, don't they?
Absolutely.
Welcome back to Big Mouth.
Thank you.
What do you collect?
Probably too much stuff, according to my missus.
Are you not of the age where you're just sort of throwing it away?
No. I'm like one of those hoarders you get on kind of Channel 5 documentaries. It's kind of constant battle for my missus to throw out my stuff.
What kind of stuff is this stuff? Is it books and records or is it other
books,
things?
Books, records, magazines. Some of which I worked on, some of which I didn't.
Yes. Have you got a loft full of a full run of Sky, like at the end of Indiana Jones?
Yes.
I've got that, like, with Select.
Yeah, the Ark of the Covenant.
Absolutely.
If you open it, a Nazi's face will melt.
Well, it certainly melts my face when I look at some of the rubbish that we used to run in the 1990s. There is no point in collecting useful things, is there?
Well, what is useful? I mean, we're being William Morris here.
Yes, we could be here all day, couldn't
we? Yeah, we could be.
Anyway, in a Two Ronnie style, we have a packed programme for you this week. Sexy black consciousness space android Janelle Monáe is back. Has the moment come for a truly mould-breaking global star? BBC Two's sprawling crime drama Collateral comes to an end next week. What did we think of this murder procedural? Well, it turns out that everything is connected to everything else. If you thought indie rock had got formulaic and tedious, steel yourself for new albums by Gokot Mozart and The Lovely Eggs. They are very much not your standard landfill indie efforts. And what's Michael and Sean's favourite flop movies, the box office disasters that didn't deserve to bomb? Pausing for a quick shout to this week's producer Sophie Black, who pulled the fat out the fire last week in fantastic fashion. We're going to get started after this quick word from Sean.
Before we get started, can we appeal to your civic-minded generosity? Big Mouth is tremendous fun and we are immensely grateful to our listeners, but we need to be able to cover our studio bills and we've come up with the solution. We're asking for your help to cover our costs. Will you buy us a virtual pint once a month via the crowdfunding platform Patreon? Not an actual pint or a real artisan hand-distilled gin in a bath, of course, but just the equivalent of £5 a month via Patreon. Our goal is to get £600 a month so we can cover our studio and production costs. That's only 120 listeners donating £5 a month. And of course, if you want to donate more and maybe buy us two virtual pints and a packet of virtual pork scratchings, that would be really welcome. Once we reach £600 a month goal, we'll start recording an extra segment of our show for Patreon listeners only. And we're already a quarter of the way there. Have a look at patreon.com/bigmouthpodcast to find out more. All we're saying is buy us a pint.
Okay, let's get going. We're going to see if we can talk about Janelle Monáe without calling her the female prince, except, oh dear, I've already done it. The Kansas-born Atlanta resident spacewoman has just released two singles ahead of her third album, Dirty Computer. Django Jane is a thumping and hilariously funny piece of full-on black empowerment hip-hop, and Make Me Feel is an immensely sexy piece of gender-bending funk, and yes, we're going to have to mention Prince again. Is the time finally right to make Janelle Monáe a planet-sized star? We're going to talk about it after a bit of Make Me Feel.
She know by the way I use my compression. that you got the answers to my confessions. It's like I'm powerful with a little bit of tender and emotional sexual bender. Mess me up, yeah, but no one does it better. There's nothing better. That's just the way you make me feel.
Make me feel like Janelle Monáe. Michael Hogan, are you a Janelle Monáe person? Are you on the Monáe? Monáe changes everything.
Yes.
Monáe, Monáe, Monáe.
Yeah.
Yes, Janelle Monáe, real name Janet Monáe. this is a girl I went to school with, probably.
Yeah.
I'm very much a fan of hers. I've liked her ever since, I think, was it Tightrope, her first hit?
Yeah.
Back in the day. And these two singles are extraordinary pieces of work, I think. I slightly prefer Django Jane. Mm-hmm. I must confess, because it's sort of, yeah, I like a sort of hard hip-hop kind of thing. And the other one is a little bit, maybe a little bit too Prince pastiche at times, but they're both absolute bangers, and I think it's very exciting. The videos are both ace as well.
Well, yeah, we can talk about the videos in a minute. I mean, on the music side, this is the third album after Archandroid or Archandroid, which he kind of just appeared out of nowhere fully formed as this kind of Metropolis robot, Art Deco, Sun Ra, space futurist, you know, intergalactic, black feminist thing that appeared just out of nowhere. There didn't seem to be any formative period. She just suddenly, she was there. And I think it really took people aback, and they didn't really know what to make of her.
Seeing her at Glastonbury, I think, around then, when and she had this kind of big kind of James Brownie kind of Soul Review kind of vibe going on, and a huge band and kind of sharp dance moves and
how many people
tailoring.
Were in her band? I imagine there are 35.
Yeah. It's like sort of Calling the Gang and Blazing Squad are on stage at the same time.
Amazing.
It was ace.
Yeah. It's like an entire James Brown Soul Review jammed into place. And I think that was in her black and white years, wasn't
yeah.
it?
Everything
was black
very
and white.
Much.
Beautifully turned out, you know, amazing suits. Do we think, I mean, obviously, you know, the kind of the shape of the world culture at the moment, we're seeing, you know, a lot of things moving into place at the same time. You're seeing, you know, black culture and hip hop expressing itself, not just through music, but through films like Black Panther and social movements alongside it. Do we think the time is right for her to sort of step up from something that music fans love into the level of world phenomenon? What do you think, Sean?
So we're saying she could go a bit opera.
Wimpy, what do you think about that? I mean, certainly she could go full Beyonce.
I think she should go for president right away. I really like her. She does seem like a composite of a lot of different elements, like this dirty computer has invented this person who is extremely right for now. Mm. But also there's obviously this throwback, this 70s idea of funk, very, very sexy, lots and lots of things that artists aren't at the moment. Yeah. And that's amazing to see. You realise how revolutionary it looks. And, you know, the explicit flirtations of those videos. I mean, they're just like, oh, my goodness, wow. And she uses the word empowering. And, yeah, she looks really empowered. And sometimes you hear women go, yeah, it's really empowering to do this, that, and wear no tights or whatever. And yet, you know, she looks like she is owning it. And you just think, God, I want to be you. Can I be you?
There was a great story in The Onion, which, of course, predicts everything by doing things that later come true. They ran a story a couple of years ago that said, everything a woman does now classified as empowering, including, you know, the bins.
Yes,
or,
you hear it all the time. And it's, absolutely sick of it. It's the women eating yogurt.
empowering yogurt.
The still pictures that
on
they
behalf
use.
Of,
yeah.
On behalf of all womankind, thing.
Yeah,
you're saying this actually qualifies properly empowering.
Oh, totally. You can disagree with me, but totally. As a lady, it's lady empowering. I felt this morning, putting on my makeup to Janelle Monáe, I felt empowered. Well, even if it was like for 5 minutes,
that's I felt even slightly empowered. As well, speaking to my inner lady, I like the idea of President Monáe as well. By the way, that sounds like an amazing rap.
I think
as well.
This could happen. It really could.
Let's talk about those videos. Sean touched on it a minute ago. The Make Me Feel video, in particular, is mentally kind of decadent, polysexual. Everybody fancies everybody else. Janelle's a bit boyish. The boys are a bit girlish. Everybody's hands are wandering all over the place. It's the hip hop. Frankie Goes to Hollywood. Relax, isn't it? It's sex all the time for everybody with everybody all the time.
I didn't spot Nasher in the background.
I don't like the idea of a hip hop Nasher somewhere. Yeah. Well,
no, it's great, and I think you're right. The time is right. I think she put out a sort of sneak peek of the videos before screenings of Black Panther, which is a very clever piece of marketing. And I think dropping these two singles at the same time is very bold and exciting as well, because he's pretty much saying, this album is going to be amazing and it's going to be so eclectic, and I can do both. I can do really credible hip-hop and I can do super shiny pop hits at the same time. Aren't I ace? And certainly the sort of production values and her kind of sexiness have kind of gone up several gears since last sort of campaign. So I think she is. I mean, there is a vibe of Beyonce's kind of Lemonade and Beyonce's Blow, I think, about the videos.
But it looks like she's having so much more fun. Well, I think it looks quite difficult to be Beyonce. I mean, you've got a full schedule, really.
Yeah, you have really achy thighs.
Yeah, but this is a person having fun, really enjoying it. A person who could not be anything other than president or a pop star.
Mm. I like the fact that you get this, on the Make Me Feel video, you get this enormously opulent, you know, luridly lit, multi-cast member sort of, you know, scene in the nightclub, and then like a verse and a half in, that's not exciting enough anymore, let's have Janelle Monáe basically in the nude playing guitar in a mesh mask surrounded by dancers, and then let's throw in a whole, you know, there's a great shot which appears to be either her or a body double writhing under a load of pink latex, and it's only there for like a quarter of a second. It's just a little extra slice of lemon in the gym.
Yeah, it's like 10 videos in one, isn't it? It's really exciting like that way, I think. It's just this, this big nightclub full of kind of anyone getting off with anyone else in there. And then there's all these nice little nods to the past. There's like a David Bowie lookalike, and there's sort of 80s arcade games.
Yeah.
And there's a Grace Jones kind of sort of backing dancers at one point. So, she's very much sort of lots of referencing to the past, but then, you know, with the sort of future soul sound as well. And it's, I think it's properly exciting, you know, and you can see that song in particular, Make Me Feel, being a, you know, it goes straight into my wedding DJ set list, I think.
I've got to DJ at an event in the end of May, and I've already stuck it straight in the folder. That's, we'd be sick of it by then. I don't know. Possibly not.
You could crank from Prince's Kiss into that, and the place would go right off.
Here we go, you see, because apparently, certain radio stations have been doing that all the time, and listeners have been going, yeah, we get it. Okay, it sounds a bit like Prince. There's nothing wrong with sounding a bit like Prince. He was himself an assembly of archetypes, from Little Richard to Sylvester to a bit Sun Ra to a dirty old man in a dirty old man's porno shop. He himself was a kind of bricolage.
But I like it because it's the bit of the period of Prince that I like. Because I don't like all of Prince. It got a bit noodly at points. And I once saw him when he did a stripped-down sort of acoustic-style live
set.
Nobody
wants that, do they?
Yeah. And this is the Raspberry Beret sort of Kiss Prince, which I really pop Prince. Oh, go on.
Stripped-down acoustic Prince makes about as much sense as 90-piece funk orchestra Ed Sheeran, doesn't it? It's just a category.
And he didn't
do any
of the hits. It was dreadful. There's a short man on stage. Can we go home now? Yeah, the magic had gone. But as I say, the Raspberry Beret, Kiss period, all that really pop Alphabet Street stuff. I love that bit.
Let's talk about the Django Jane video and song. And that's this is her in a gigantic military squad of girls in leather jackets, and she's literally sitting on a throne talking about being. It's quite sort of Dirty South hip hop, and it is full on. Woman powerful, the highly melanated, I believe she refers, as in, this is like music, this is black music formed by black people. And it's just absolutely full of great lines, isn't it?
Yeah, there's the, you know, let the vagina have a monologue, which is the one you're probably thinking of.
Hit the button. But also I was thinking of the line, emoticons, Decepticons and Autobots who twist the plot. It's like, as well as the kind of politics, there's joy and silliness in this music that makes it...
Yeah, she's putting something in there for the kind of 40-something nerd, which is nice, isn't it?
Well, I think probably if you are an 18-something nerd, you've grown up on terrible Transformers movies, so you know these things as well. But it's a proper shut-up men song, so I will shut up, Sean, and you can tell me what you think about Django Jane.
Well, I liked it, but I didn't like it as much as Made Me Feel. Because it's harder, it's because it's more hip-hop. So I just like the real poppiness and the joy of Made Me Feel. So this is good. I like it. Mm. Go ahead. You do your stuff. But it wasn't my favourite. Mm-hmm. I like what she's saying still. I don't have any fault with that. But for me, with the kind of pop hat on. Yeah.
I think she's really good at the proper pop star thing, though, of sloganising, as well as the line that Michael just mentioned there, the in Make Me Feel, I'm an emotional sexual vendor line in Make Me Feel is like, that's going to go on T-shirts. And it's gonna be
as someone licks a lollipop in the background, you see that bit? It's in a very lascivious way.
Good pop stars are good sloganists. So Prince actually did work on this record before, as Janelle said, he passed on to another frequency, which is a very science fiction-y thing to say.
Yeah, it's lovely, but really good.
And apparently the album is going to be an emotion picture by Janelle Monáe, which is, again, incredibly Princey. It's impossible to talk about without talking about Prince, isn't it? She's generally a good thing and good at being a pop star.
Yes, and someone channeling that sort of Prince, I think, is excellent. It's we need a bit more of that. We need a bit more of that pomp. You don't even really miss pomp in rock and that silliness.
Absolutely.
You want
there's
that
no pomp about Ed Sheeran, is there?
No, larger than life and that cartoon, but as I say, in that really amazing I'm doing what I want to do way, and I'm actually quite a good thing.
Well, I mean, you know when things fade out of pop, things that used to be enormous that then disappear and you forget the moment that they disappeared. Keeping It Real kind of vanished a few years ago, didn't it? Keeping It Real was throughout the noughties, you had nothing but DJs, you know, rap stars, musicians talking about how real they were and how real they were keeping it.
Yeah, still got love for the streets, absolutely.
Yeah, and it all just seems to have dissolved because people want to make it unreal now, make it larger than life and stranger and weirder and more colourful. That's the way to do it. That's
absolutely
the better way to do it.
The Django Jane video I thought was, it really reminded me of Public Enemy, you know, the sort of S1Ws, yeah. The sort of flanking her in their sort of berets. And
it's not S1Ws, it's SJWs, Michael. All up in your grill, yes. But in a good way. Yeah.
And you know, and you're right, there were loads of quotable lines in there. There was, you know, we're going to start a motherfucking pussy riot. We're going to have to put them on a pussy diet.
Family show, Michael. Family.
Cue the violins and violas. I like that bit.
Which
before
is a great
it goes
bit.
into the sort of instrumental drop, and it's just brilliant.
Yeah, it's fantastic.
And she made a fandroid out of your girlfriend.
Well, I'm a massive fandroid, and we think she's a good thing. So let's move on to a bit more music. We always ask our guests to bring a tune in, an editor's recommendation in the style of Britannia Music Club. Michael, what have you brought for us and why have you brought it?
Well, in a massive clanking gear change from Janelle Monáe, I've brought in Stop, The Mighty Stop by Erasure. I went to see Erasure at Hammersmith Apollo on Saturday night and, it was a glorious night out for the older punter. They've been going for 33 years, scarily. So everyone there was kind of, you know, 45 plus.
Time for a revolution.
Yes. But they're just, you know, it's just non-stop bangers. You know, they've got such a back catalogue. There's like 20 killer singles and they played 15 of them, say. You know, the obligatory, here's a new one off our new album, let's go to the bar kind of bits. and Andy Bell was kind of growing old disgracefully. He was in a sort of tattooed body stocking. said he was modelling himself on Liz Taylor's Cleopatra meets Mrs. Slocum, which is very accurate. And he was sort of had, you know, a little pot belly in his body stocking, didn't care. It was a brilliant gig. And they played a cover of Atomic by Blondie, which sort of took the roof off. And there were loads of sort of big moments, but Stop was probably the biggest.
Well, let's transport ourselves back to Hammersmith Apollo last week. Here we go. It's Erasure with Stop. Together again. Erasure with Stop was chosen by our guest, Michael Hogan. Right then, let's have some television, specifically BBC Two's major four-part drama Collateral, which comes to an end next week. We've already seen how the shooting of a London pizza delivery man opens up a world of people trafficking, corruption and the abuse of power. But are we enjoying it? And is it an accurate image of the underbelly of modern Britain? Let's have a taste.
Can we just think this thing through? Let me know if I'm getting too fast for you. Why would anyone kill a pizza delivery man?
And how could a gunman know who he was going to kill?
It doesn't make any sense.
That's very good. You got your speech ready for the superintendent.
There was a murder in my constituency.
We heard gunfire.
It's a Muslim killing, right?
Can't we just say it was a human being who was shot down on a British street?
They're trying to take everything from us. It's a way of life they want to destroy.
We believe your brother was killed deliberately.
Because he knew something.
Sam Spence, MI5. We believe there's a national security dimension.
They want your information, but they don't want to give up any of theirs.
We're answerable to everyone, and we control no one. People no longer believe in institutions, and it's for exactly the reasons you're giving me.
A taster of BBC Two's Collateral with Kerry Mulligan, Billy Piper and John Sim. Now, Michael Hogan, you're our man on the TV desk. This is written by David Hare. It's got major stars. This has got important drama written all over it, hasn't it?
It has.
Does it deliver on the important drama front?
Not quite, I don't think. It sort of comes pretty close. It's interesting and good and ambitious and all those sort of things, but it's kind of quite flawed and it's kind of, yeah, it's a sort of 7 out of 10 for me.
Set it up for us then, for people who haven't been watching it and might want to catch up on iPlayer. What exactly is happening here and why is it happening?
Well, we start with a pizza parlour under the arches of South East London, and a driver goes out to deliver a Quattro 4 Mudgee to Billy Piper, who's playing a posh sort of single mother. And then the pizza delivery driver is shot in the first scene. And then we kind of scroll outwards and pan out to this whole range of characters. The local MP, played by John Sim. The local lesbian vicar, played by Nicola Walker.
Everybody needs a local lesbian vicar. You don't want to travel to get to the lesbian vicar.
Hey, I'm from Stoke Newington. We've got several.
We export lesbian vicars, yes.
And then all these characters kind of, and you realise that there's a conspiracy. It's a lot about immigration and asylum seekers in there, which David Hare describes as sort of the biggest issue of the century. And it kind of turns into a big, sprawling state of the nation conspiracy thriller. The problem for me with it is the script, which is a little bit clunky and clanky and a bit stagey at times. You know, he's a playwright. You might expect a bit of that, but some of the dialogue is sort of jarring the exposition, which I think people who are used to watching really top-notch telly can spot a mile off now. He might have got away with it in the 80s, but I don't think you can get away with that now. And I think that sort of just takes you out of the moment a little bit when someone kind of goes, yes, call my... John Sim, I think, last week, literally said, call that French au pair and tell her to get my ex-wife out of bed. You know what I mean? It's like, all right, you know. It's not like Neighbours. So I think that's what kind of loses it some points. And weirdly, John Sim and Billy Piper, who are both brilliant actors and sort of two of my favourite TV actors, I think their characters are the weak point of it as well. I think the kind of the more underbelly-ish characters, the kind of the people traffickers and the sort of the pizza people, they're really interesting. Nicola Walker's brilliant as lesbian vicar as always, but doesn't have enough to do. I'm trying not to give. I've seen the episode for the finale. I'm trying not to give anything away.
Don't.
It ends well, I think. It ends. Yeah. You know. There's a lot of pressure on sort of season finales now. Everyone's straight on the internet afterwards to sort of say, they didn't tie up all the loose ends and that wasn't satisfying. Mm. I think this one is a fairly satisfying one. But yeah, I think when you look back at the series overall, there are big flaws in it.
I think I agree with you about that. The bit that I found most convincing was when John Sim and Billy Piper are arguing in the kitchen. And I thought, okay, he knows what he's doing here. It's marital arguments in posh parts of London. You can see this on the stage at the National. John Sim and Billy Piper in Unhappy Marriage by David Hare. But when it gets into having to wander around the Isle of Dogs and people traffickers and assassins and all the rest of it, it did get, I think you're absolutely right, very, very stagey and full of lines like, you could have done anything with your life, but I chose to do this.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And you've got, I mean, the Carey Mulligan character to me was the most fantastical. So it's she's a hard-nosed policewoman who's pregnant for, you know, just for reasons that don't seem to have dramatic significance so far. But she used to be a teacher, and before that she was a gymnast.
Pole vaulter.
And you kind of think, pick something, mate.
Yeah.
Make a decision.
The pole vaulter thing is a brilliant curveball, isn't it? Who would ever...
But it doesn't go anywhere, unless it does go anywhere. I'm thinking, can I see the pole vaulting past? Can I get the why? Why was she a gymnast, and why does that make sense? Why was she then a teacher? Because that is a lot of different...
Do you want to sort of save the day in episode 4 by kind of vaulting over...
Yes, she needs to vault. That's got to save someone from immigration hell in the detention centre.
That's what I really don't want to happen.
I wanted it to make sense.
And there's another key character, which is there's a soldier, and we won't say what the soldier is doing or why she's doing it, but she keeps going to see a psychiatrist, and behind the psychiatrist is
the golf clubs.
And the minute those golf clubs appeared, we said somebody's going to get beaten to death with one of them before long. And then they appear again. Chekhov's golf clubs. What are they doing there? And how many holes does Chekhov play? Who's going to get battered with the golf club? Sean, in general, what did you think of it?
In general, I thought the subject matter is amazing. So I really want to know about the hidden underworld of immigration, people who have to sleep in garages, who haven't got their papers or have got their papers. We don't know whether they're Syrian, whether from Iraq. That stuff's fascinating. And I thought the detention centre was fascinating. You are there for an indefinite period of time and you are going home. Stuff like that was brilliant. But I absolutely agree with Michael, is characters telling each other what they think of each other. They all say what's on their mind. There's no subtext. It's like EastEnders. Oh, look, you're doing this. I don't like that. No, I don't like you either. It's just like, please, could we have some layering or something?
Yeah.
And I think that the police are the weakest characters for me. The Carey Mulligan character. She's sort of, are the police meant to be really good at this or really bad? They don't know. Are these incompetent police? Are they great police? She just sort of goes around being a former gymnast in a bad mood. And I just couldn't understand her and what they were trying to say about how these various mechanics of special forces and police and immigration and MP all and vicar all work together.
Yeah,
I think, I
really like Carey Mulligan in this, not the character particularly. I really like her performance. I think she's always brilliant in everything. I've liked her ever since she was in Doctor Who as Sally Sparrow in one of the best ever Doctor Who episodes, Blink. And I really like her kind of, she's kind of got a kind of weary, sort of cynical, middle classy, do-goody kind of vibe to her in this that I quite like, and she's very she puts down men very well in this, particularly by episode 4. It does go a bit somewhere, like she turns into more of a, there's lots of people sort of say things like, oh, you know, you're playing politics as a policeman, it's all about deal making and stuff like that, and she does. Yes. That does come through by the end of the story.
Right, okay. Because, yes, we see a lot of ends that aren't tied up yet.
Yeah.
I'm on episode 3. And I'm still thinking, I'm not sure where this is going and what, you know, like you're saying, some statements seem to go into midair and some, I hope, are going to go towards the plot.
What I found kind of dissatisfying about it was I kept thinking, I don't believe these people. I don't believe these people are representative of the various types, policeman, politician, criminal, you know, local member of the community. They didn't ring true. And I think the reason is we've had like an almost 20-year sustained run of excellent cop shows, mostly American, where police work is presented as a workplace. So the characters, you know, it's just their working day. And anybody's working day is kind of leavened by humour, by in-jokes, by asides, by little personal moments. That's why The Wire is incredible, because you're just watching a bunch of, firstly, police and then teachers and then newspaper people going through their working day. The plot is almost secondary to it. This is entirely plot-driven, and people don't behave in a workplace the way they do in Collateral. They don't talk entirely in plot points. Mm-hmm. They don't talk entirely in expository kind of, you know, you could have done anything with your life, but now you're doing this. You're making a real horlocks of this, Sergeant. Who says that? And the god-awful MI5 guy, who is basically Alan Partridge with security clearance.
Yeah. With Anton Dubek's face.
Yeah. None of them rang true, and that was my problem with it.
I quite like the MI5 bit, because it was funny. At least it was funny. Yeah. He was playing a villain, and he's a cartoonish villain. And I thought,
he's a bit UKIP-y.
There was something to his character.
Cartoonishness I found tiresome. And the bit where there's a hitman, not necessarily the one that you think, but there's a character has killed somebody and sends a text that says, job done. And my wife said, don't these people watch television? You know, that is the nobody would do that. You'd send a text that said something like dog sick. The code word. You wouldn't send a text that said job done. It just none of it.
I thought that reveal of the shooter was very well done in episode 1, where you see them kind of march off and then go into, I think it's Paddington Station or Waterloo Station, into the loos, and then kind of peel off their black ninja suit and wrap it all up in plastic and stuff, and there's a bit of a surprise there about who it is.
Yeah.
I thought that was really nicely done. That was kind of like a little sort of thrilling 24 type moment.
It is a great bit of dramatic manipulation, but it just goes back to my major problem with the whole thing, which is please make up your mind what this story is about, because he seems to be trying to tell the everything story. It's about immigration and the army and the far right and poverty
and a bit of New Labour, because John Sims a bit kind of thick of itty,
and the media and depression and religion. It's trying to be about everything, and you know, if you can marshal, I mean, that's to me great. Make a five-series epic like The Wire, and then you've made the everything story. But to do it in four episodes on BBC Two, I thought it was asking too
much.
With
a lot of people who live in nice houses as well. It's fed up.
There are, aren't there? The vicar's house is lovely.
We get one council house, and everybody else lives in these palaces. You just think, come on, play.
Did you notice
the nun from
Derry Girls?
I was just about to say, on the upside, it's got the horrible Sister Michael from Derry Girls.
Who is
in
she?
It. She's running the detention centre.
Oh,
she's the kind of chief guard.
Oh, okay. She was great. Yeah. I didn't recognise her. That means good acting.
She runs the detention centre exactly in the same way she runs the school in Derry. To me, this felt to me like the kind of show the BBC thinks it ought to be making.
Well, obviously it did, because it did make it. And it must have cost a fortune.
But more
as
in the sense of, like, that, you know, rather than here's a strong pitch on a tale, more a case of, well, we as the BBC, we need to be making drama of this style.
Yes. Like it's a bit like London Spy, isn't it? You remember that? It's kind of like, it's very much a BBC Two drama, like a little bit artier than your average thriller that might be on BBC One. I mean, I think it's a little bit unfair. I think most things will suffer if you compare them to The Wire.
Yeah.
And particularly things that are made on a tiny budget with one location, pretty much, you know, just shooting on the streets of London. But I don't know. Someone said something on social media that I thought was interesting, that David Hare writing about kind of modern Britain felt a bit like sort of Woody Allen writing about things, like a sort of old bloke trying to understand things and not quite getting it. So some of it felt a bit clunky at times.
Yeah.
And I think there was some truth to that.
Yeah. I mean, I agree that you can't expect it to match the budget of The Wire, but there's, you know, it doesn't cost anything to have your characters speak in the manner of a real policeman in a real police environment rather than regurgitate plot points. I'm giving it, you know, it's impressive and brave, but it's only a 3 out of 5 for me. What do you think, Stan?
I might watch to the end of it, which I think is quite good, because, I'm ploughing through episode 3. I have stopped midway. Yeah. What I would say, I might watch the end of it, which is good. I'm not going to give it a rating, but I might do that just to see what happens.
Just sit there. Come on, lesbian vicar. We're rooting for you.
I think the episode, the final episode, is interesting.
Okay. Interesting.
Okay, interesting.
There we go. Right, we're going to have a bit more music. Sean, it's time for your choice of tune. What tune have you brought in?
I have brought in Tiswas by Sleaford Mods. I don't think this show has had enough Sleaford Mods, and I don't think I even need to describe them. People will know their work. They are the breath of fresh air. They are keeping it real. I also used to watch Tiswas religiously as a kid. It's probably not actually about the show, this record, but it's one of the few that doesn't have a load of swearing in it. So I think we really need a blast of Sleaford Mods, so I brought it in.
Okay, let's have a go. Here we go. Tiswas by Sleaford Mods.
Paul Ramau, Gear Fiver. The land that time forgot is on repeat. I can hear the screams of people who want to be me. They want to shave my top and tell the others that they were the ones who made me.
Sleaford Mods there with Tiswas, and while it was playing, Sean was discussing how it's about broken Britain, and there's no Spit the Dog involved.
There is Spit the Dog in it.
But it's not that Spit the Dog.
No, it must be Spit the Dog, like metaphor.
Metaphor. Spit the Dog. Metaphor. Well, sticking with music and probably staying in a similar vein, Sean, you can take us into the next bit.
Yes. Is there a more deliberately downtrodden genre of music in the world than so-called sad and lonely indie rock? Wayface boys and girls sometimes playing Wayface songs, or the only other option, lads, in 2000 inverted commas, with their umpteenth generation Oasis knockoffs and those tunes that sound like they're singing on the toilet. Sometimes it feels like all the good ideas are happening somewhere else, as indie goes shuffling round Millets for a new hat. But this week at least, there are two albums from Planet Indie that sound a bit different, and they want to do their own thing. DIY? Get it? DIY. It's like indie.
We're with you.
We're trying to do. Go-Kart Mozart are the current musical vehicle of Lawrence, once the windswept and mysterious leader of Felt, who I loved Felt, and then frontman of Glam Monsters Denim. They released their additive-laden mini-album Mozart's Mini-Mart this week. And the fifth album by Lancastrian noise pop duo The Lovely Eggs is out this week too. After years of DIY racket, This Is Eggland is produced by Dave Fridman, who helped make the Flaming Lips and Mercury Rev sound so vast, and some would say luscious. So, what is Michael Hogan going to make of these singular artists? Let's have a listen to Wiggy Giggy by The Lovely Eggs and When You're Depressed by Go-Kart Mozart.
When You're Depressed by Go-Kart Mozart. Now, we're going to start with Go-Kart Mozart. Sian and I are very much on board for Lawrence. But Michael Hogan, what did you make of it? Was this a new experience for you?
Yeah.
Were you familiar with the works of Go-Kart Mozart, Denham and Lawrence from Felt?
No, I was familiar with Felt and familiar with Denham, both of which I quite liked. But I really would rather you didn't make me listen to that album. Ever again.
It's quite different, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I kind of found it interesting. It's got this kind of artificially perky kind of synth music and properly depressing, you know, genuine. Like, I mean, some of the songs are actually about depression. Some of the other ones are just depressing. And I don't know, it just felt like a spoof. And maybe it is partly, but it felt like a sort of John Shuttleworth album or a Frank Sidebottom album or something that the kind of Vic and Bob did during a kind of, you know, a sketch show.
Well, I did. One of Denham's albums was called Novelty Rock. Mm. To me, the gag with Denham and Go-Kart Mozart, the gag is it's not a gag. He's serious about this. Mm. He genuinely wants to make music that is so crass and brightly coloured and brutally capital P pop that it's almost too much and too hard to take. Sian, bring the listeners up to date with where Lawrence is at.
Well, Lawrence, as we know, is in Felt, who are maybe one of the archetypal 80s indie bands in that they were mystical, they were peculiar, they were obtuse, you couldn't get into them, and they were four men from Birmingham just doing wheelie wheelie guitar pop. And so Lawrence, having fed up of making no money for years, and probably fed up of the indie scene, just decides to go completely pop with Denham and make something that reminds him of his favourite records from the 70s, like Lieutenant Pigeon. And, you know, it's bubblegum. Glitterbeat across with bubblegum pop. And he does Denham for a bit, and that doesn't quite work and make him the pop star that he's always wanted to be. So he's just continued, and Go-Kart Mozart is the even poppier version of Denham. And as you say, the squeaky, icky 60s sound that it's quite jarring, and yet I love this. Absolutely loved it.
It's like Denham is like a glass of horrible own brand supermarket
squash.
It's
like cherry-aid, isn't
yeah.
it? It's really cherry-aid.
But Go-Kart Mozart is like that, except before you dilute it and you just like yeah. take a nip of it.
And then you've added Lucozade to and probably a Jägermeister.
And your whole teeth are singing.
No, it's yeah. more like sort of Jenny Agutter drinking her own urine.
That was Sally Field.
Oh, was it? Is it the wrong one? I've got the wrong one.
You know why it isn't? Because your own urine is a natural product. Urine. Yeah, they are. Well, absolutely. Does it look like Tizer?
I had a Barocca this morning. It might do.
That is the point of Go-Kart Mozart. A total artificiality.
But if this record was full of Let's Fall in Love, Baby lyrics and Isn't Everything Wonderful and The Sun is Shining and it was as sort of twee and squeaky as the music, then it would be a complete disaster. But it's about Lawrence's real life. Unrelatable as Lawrence wants to be, he wants to be a mega pop star and have limos outside the door. It's completely relatable. It's about having no money and having no friends and being depressed.
There's
and watching
a song called I'm Living in Relative Poverty.
Oh, I loved it.
Which
I
is pointless.
I'm Living on a Tenner a Day. Is
yeah,
that,
yeah,
is that
yeah,
one?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, which has those sort of doo-wop 50s rock and roll and 70s rock and roll things coming in.
I sort of admire it in a way. I admire the kind of, you know, the pluck of doing this. But it just sounded like, you know, Jarvis Cocker having a nervous breakdown.
Should they put that on the label on the front of the record? This sounds like Jarvis Cocker having a nervous breakdown.
Which, you know, I don't know. I don't want to see that. I don't want to listen to that.
I think, like a lot of, in some respects, it's not difficult music because it's kind of like Fisher-Price pop, isn't it? It's like crude and brutal and straightforward. But in other respects, it is really difficult because it's so, you know, highly coloured and additive laden that you have to make yourself give it a go. And I did and found myself you know, this was years ago on their early records. It was a leap, but when I got into it, I really got into it and genuinely like and enjoy it. And the songs can be really poignant and really funny as at the same time. There's a song called Facing the Scorn of Tomorrow's Generation, which he's been doing for 20 years. And yet there's another one. There's another one called A Black Hood on His Head, which is about an ISIS execution.
Yeah, it's amazing that song.
Describes
it in
brutal detail.
Or watching it on the internet to this bubblegum pop in the background. That is incredible. And the When You're Depressed, I think, is a genius record. I think it is actually genius.
Yeah.
To put those elements together and for that to work, but it to be about your life. And this is really coming from Lawrence. He's not pretending to be anything. He's not pretending to be Bono here. That's amazing. It's brave and it's wonderful and it works.
I think it's a form of heroism to do this, because a very small number of people really want this record. Its chances of making its money back are slim. He finished it in 2013. He's been kicking around for ages and ages. And yet he ploughs on, indefatigable. And all the millions of pop stars who are supposedly for real and telling you how they really feel aren't. They are playing a role. They are, look at the writing credit. It's 28 writers with their heartfelt ballad. This is, like it or not, admire it or not, the real Lawrence. This is what he really wants to say. And I think that is laudable. You don't have to like it. And I'm not expecting you to ever listen to this record ever again, Michael. But I do think what it isn't is cynical. It is truthful about itself.
Yes, and I think you're right. And there are two or three really interesting songs on it, but there's 17 songs in half an hour.
On the upside,
at least it's over in about half an hour.
On the upside, most of those songs are about a minute long.
Yeah.
So it's kind of, you know, he's not taking up a lot of time, is he?
Yeah.
It's like, to me, the I mean, there's a member of the Glitter Band on this record playing Simmons drums. Who plays Simmons drums anymore? That kind of really crunchy, you know, EastEnders, you know. It's like, it's all made out of the bits and the detritus of the 70s and the 80s, but it's done with love. And I find it really impressive. And it actually can be quite tender. The version of Roger Whittaker's A New World, you know, A New World in the Morning, the Radio 2 classic, I found it genuinely affecting. You know, it's properly, well, he's made the song his own. He's really nailed it. And
he smashed it out of the park.
He smashed it. He literally
110%
smashed it.
You're going through to boot camp, Lawrence.
Yeah. Absolutely, yeah. Well, I mean, he needs to get a good square meal in boot camp. I think Lawrence would... But also, the way Lawrence's mind is made is composed, I think Lawrence would genuinely consider himself a contender on The X Factor or Britain's Got Talent.
Oh, he's probably gone for it.
I'm sure he has.
I would be surprised if he hasn't turned up for that Britain's
Got
Talent.
Yeah, he's kind of like the male Honey G. Do you remember Honey G?
I do.
Oh, yeah, but he's
no,
not.
No, he's not.
He's,
she was awful.
He's right, slightly deluded community cases.
But he's
with
a
Bon Tempe organ in Dixon.
I disagree. He's a genuine outsider artist.
Mm.
And you might want to keep him outside and lock the door.
Look, Primitive Painters, I've got a lot of time for. Some of the Denim records were good in the Britpop era.
See, I didn't like Felt at all. I thought it was pretentious and silly. This is what it's about for me. You know, I don't want to hear Let the Snakes Crinkle Their Heads Unto Death.
Well, if we're
I want to hear Drinking on Bongo by Gokhan Mozart.
I feel like I've gone on Lawrence's journey in the way that I did really like Felt. Because I was that age, because I was 13, thought Felt were brilliant, and that's the thing that I thought that all pop stars should be. So I have been on this journey. We've been there together through to boot camp or wherever we're going. And I actually feel quite touched by that. Lawrence has shared his life with us, the fans. Yeah. I mean, I'm a bit like that, but that's probably me being deranged. I just think that there's so much honesty has made me warm to it so much.
Yes.
Will you listen to it again?
Yes, I would. Yeah.
Well, the New Potatoes, Charlie Brooker.
The New Potatoes,
But the New Potatoes by Denim, Charlie Brooker chose it as one of his Desert Island Discs. Mm. And this is a song that a lot of people will literally scream, please turn that off.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we were on holiday in Greece a while ago and had Summer Smash by Denim, the famous unreleased Summer Smash, which...
The controversial.
Yes, because this is Lawrence's life story in a nutshell, isn't it? He records a perfectly crafted summer hit song, calls it Summer Smash, and the week it's coming out, Princess Diana dies in a car crash, and the record is pulled and not allowed to come out.
And they ban it from radio.
And it's banned from everything. But we had it on. I found a copy. I had it on in the car in Greece, and I was told, if you do not take that off immediately, I'm going home on the next plane. So it divides people, the world of Lawrence, but that's good,
I think. Yes.
Should we talk about the Lovely Eggs?
Ooh.
The Lovely Eggs are a two-piece married couple. Like most married couples, they're a two-piece. From Lancaster. They are unimaginably indie in the way that would scare, say, London Grammar or somebody to death. Steve Lamacq, coloured vinyl, 7 inches, releases on Two Pure, touring with Art Brut and Half Japanese. They are almost meta indie. Mm-hmm. Now, Sian, this stuff is in your wheelhouse, but you didn't like it very much,
did you? Can you describe my wheelhouse? Can it get out of my wheelhouse now?
Well, you're
out of my wheelhouse.
Indie-friendly lady.
Do you know what I did? I cleaned the kitchen floor to this record. It really needed doing. and the kitchen floor is a worse place for it. My kitchen floor, when I look at it, now reminds me of the songs on this album. And I know lots of people really like this sort of music. It is the DIY thing. They don't have a manager. They don't have a record label, or they don't have, you know, like a car or something like that.
It's they don't have any instruments or songs.
They do it all themselves. Yeah, that's fine. That ethos, that's fine. But I felt the music was absolutely awful.
Okay.
And I couldn't wait to turn it off.
Ringing endorsement there from Sean Patton. And Michael Hogan, what did you think of The Lovely Eggs?
Pretty much the same as Sean, I'm afraid.
Okay.
It made me kind of, I don't know, it kind of made me quite anxious and sort of annoyed. And I wanted to sort of get it off as soon as possible. It was kind of like, it just felt like some students messing about to me. Do you know what I mean? It was like, oh, let's put some demonic witches laughter on. Let's have some random vocal effects. Let's fade songs in and out randomly. Let's change gear halfway through a song, like, you know, the Cardiacs or something.
Yeah.
And it just made a right old racket. And maybe I'm not, you know, maybe I'm too old and cynical. Maybe I'm not stoned enough or whatever. Because it is kind of got a psychedelic kind of vibe to it. But it just sounded like, and some of the vocals were so petulant and sulky sounding, kind of like, you know, like when the kids in School of Rock sing a song about having too much homework. It's a bit like
that. Well, these are the real concerns of today's young people, Mike. I mean, what's the matter with you? I mean, you just want to silence the young people. Ordinary.
It was just willfully obtuse. And you know, when, you know, I listen to it on Spotify, and I don't have a Spotify account, you know, so I get ads on Spotify. And it's probably the only occasion when I've been relieved to hear the ads until they came up during that.
Well, ordinarily, I think I'll probably agree with the pair of you, because I get annoyed by sort of parochial, tiny indie stuff that doesn't look any further than, you know, can you get a limited edition and painted 7-inch out on record shop day. However, I found myself rather enjoying this. And I think the reasons are...
You've gone soft.
No, I think the reasons are, I like its bloody-mindedness. I like the fact that she's singing in her own accent. She's not affecting anything at all. Also, I found behind the wall of sludgy noise, it's actually quite harmonic and quite sort of... it's mentioned heroism with Lawrence from Go-Kart Mozart. There is a kind of epicness to it behind all that noise and all that racket that reminded me of the very early days of the Flaming Lips, before they went pop and arrangements and before they discovered how to make hit singles, when it was just like 60 guitars blaring away.
Now, I have a problem with the Flaming Lips, you see, and I felt the same thing, is that they were trying to be so real. It seems forced. It seems put upon. There's something really artificial about it, as realer as it is trying to sound. As it keeps going down those routes, the less I'm finding it genuine.
Well, I don't care whether it's genuine or not. I just like the fact that, you know, what you're hearing is kind of a set of, if you were to pluck away all the, you know, all the gunge and the grime, some quite sort of poignant and
why don't they pluck away the grunge and the grime then? Because it sounds like they've got one guitar effects pedal.
But the reason is because
one idea, and you're right. Some behind it, there's some songs, but you can't get to them because the tinny student racket in the way is just too annoying.
But that is the point, isn't it? The point is, what if you played beautiful, poignant songs and it sounded like a big roaring racket? I find that exciting. It's a bit Melody Maker 1987. Mm. It's a bit My Bloody Valentine. It's a bit kind of like, why, you know, it's a bit, you know, we've all been to the extremes of sound and heard things that are hurting the ear. Why would you do it again? But then if you ally it to some just interesting and quite sort of, you know, I found some of the arrangements quite moving in a way that, you know, in a weird way, Half Man, Half Biscuit can, although they're singing about daytime telly and bus schedules and annoying, you know, comedians and tedious people you meet, you know, in your local branch of B&Q, the music behind it can often be up there with Joy Division. You know, take away the lyrics about those things and you've got something.
I don't know, the lady from the band, Holly Ross, described it, I think it's in the press release, as it sounds like a chip shop on fire, which I think is a brilliant description. But a chip shop on fire also sounds really exciting. This isn't exciting.
It
sounds like it's like a chip shop that's been sort of slightly flooded. It's like depressing chip shop. It's not like there's no batter exploding.
There's no saveloys flying about. And like I say, I usually detest this kind of stuff, and I did find it quite exciting. And I mean, particularly the track that we played, Wiggy Giggy, which appears to be going back to gigs. Yeah.
And they
Sean's
called face it is a picture. Wiggy Giggy.
Yeah.
Well,
but I quite like that. I like the sound. I like the arrangement. Hey, you know, did you not enjoy the basic suicidal refusal to have a hit and be only themselves? Did you?
I quite like, you know, there's a song called Dickhead and there's a song called Would You Fuck?
Yeah,
and,
Would You Fuck? Would you do that?
You know, you but the sort of titles of all they had going for them, really. I mean, Sean played Sleaford Mods before, and I really like Sleaford Mods. There's kind of there's something sort of visceral and angry and really poppy and witty and clever about Sleaford Mods. But at the same time, they have this kind of lo-fi DIY aesthetic, and whereas this is just like.
You see,
amateurs.
I think the difference, right? So why I like the Sleaford Mods is I know that if they get rich enough to buy themselves new kitchens, they'd sing about having a new kitchen and it being a bit crap or it being great. Whereas I think the Lovely Eggs would pretend they've still got a working class Lancastrian kitchen
and it's
near the chip shop. And I think there's something about, there's a front to it. I just don't get it. I don't buy it. We're so DIY.
Sleaford
no, come on, you got a Waitrose
Sleaford
sometimes.
Sleaford Mods write a great song about those kind of soft closed drawers, wouldn't they?
Yeah, that's the thing. You know that it's going to come from them, whereas this I feel is a big put on.
Did we not start this show talking about how great it is that Janelle Monáe doesn't care about keeping it real or being real? And now you're condemning the poor old Lovely Eggs for not keeping it real.
No, because they are saying we're real and it's not. Janelle Monáe, look, we're getting a bit meta here, but is being a pop star. They're trying to be anti-pop stars, and I don't buy it. I don't buy the shtick.
Listeners, do you think the Lovely Eggs are for real or not for real? Tweet hashtag for real to us. Anyway, well, look, I like the fact it's divided the room.
Mm.
You're all wrong and I'm right. That's good. Records should divide people, and I think that is... Well, look, neither of these records are for everybody, by definition. They're not for neither of them. For Michael, who's sitting there getting body language listens.
He likes Eurasia. Yeah.
But I'm glad they exist. I'm particularly.
I couldn't believe you made me listen to both of them. Frankly.
Well, they were only half an hour long.
You should have got the housework done because then you're at least. Yeah. That's what I did. I thought at least I'm using my time wisely here.
How is your kitchen floor?
It's as I say now. Reminds me of the Lovely Eggs record. So it's dreadful.
Next time you come on, Michael, don't worry. We'll have Coldplay for you. It'll be fine.
Oi!
Finally, let's talk about the movies for a bit. Specifically, flops that shouldn't have flopped. Everyone has a favourite movie that should have done a lot better, and you may find it personally hurtful that your favourite didn't actually become part of everyone's world. Unlike with music, there's no bragging value in that rare pressing or that never-heard fifth album. Flop movies are just flops. So we've asked Michael and Sean to choose the movie that should have been huge but wasn't. Michael, what are you choosing?
Well, I agonise over this. I've got a list of about six that I could talk about. I thought of Office Space.
Yes.
Which I love.
That's got cult following.
Ooh,
now.
Yeah. I don't know if that counts. Scott Pilgrim versus the World, which I like, which flopped at the box office as well. Mm. Kiss Kiss Bang Bang. Have you ever seen that? Robert Downey Jr. and Val Kilmer, kind of noir, LA, slightly camp meta detective story.
No. Do you know who directed that?
No.
Okay.
Heathers. I was surprised that Heathers...
Oh, come on, Heathers is a hit.
No,
yeah,
I
Heathers,
no,
surely,
no.
Surely
Heathers
is.
Had a $2 million budget, $2 million budget, and only made half of it back. It took $1 million at the US box office.
Yeah, but is that funny Hollywood economics, though?
They will subsequently have made 100 times back.
I'm sure
that,
they did, I'm sure they did, but I was quite surprised to learn. But I guess it came along, you know, in the sort of John Hughes kind of era, and people just didn't get it. It kind of...
Which
but the... anyway, the one I've plumped for, if that's okay, is The Tall Guy. Do you know The Tall Guy?
Oh,
wasn't that...
It was Richard Curtis's first
film script. It's Jeff Goldblum
in it.
Yes.
Jeff Goldblum's in it. It's Emma Thompson's film debut.
You said Emma Thompson. Is it Emma Thompson?
Yeah, whoa.
Emma Thompson. Emma Thompson, yeah.
Mel Smith, the late, great Mel Smith, directed it. And it's from 1989, and it's very much a neglected classic, I think. And it took £500,000 at the box office, which is a shame. And doesn't ever get shown on TV. I don't know anyone who's got a DVD of it, but it's really, really good. It's Jeff Goldblum plays this American actor who is a straight man to Rowan Atkinson, whose character is called Ron Anderson, very thinly veiled version of himself in the West End.
From not the 10 o'clock news.
Yes. And he falls in love with a nurse who's called Kate Lemon, played by Emma Thompson. And then he gets fired. And the best bit, though, is he lands on his feet and he lands the lead role in a new RSC musical called Elephant about the life of John Merrick.
Yes.
And it's this brilliant...
Is it Elephant with an exclamation?
Yeah, yeah, of course. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's like a
Oliver.
Musical, isn't it?
Yeah. And it's just this brilliant spoof of kind of Andrew Lloyd Webber musicals. There's a big song called He's Packing His Trunk.
Oh,
and,
yes,
and the big emotional finale is everyone singing Somewhere Up in Heaven, There's an Angel with Big Ears. and it's just this sort of note perfect kind of satire of West End musicals. It's really good. And there's a sex scene in it where Emma Thompson gets some toast stuck to her bum. I mean, you know, it's got it all. Suggs pops up singing It Must Be Love, kind of like, you know, in the street. Oh. So there's lots of things that you kind of, there's lots of kind of Richard Curtisisms in it that you'll spot from other films. You know what I mean? He lots of kind of slightly cheesy rom-com elements, but it's really warm and really likeable, and it's a show. It's a neglected classic.
How did it go down critically when it first appeared? Did it get
quite badly? I think because it's quite cutesy in places, and there's things like, you know, when Jeff Goldblum falls in love, he does some cartwheels in front of the moon, and then Suggs pops up singing "It Must Be Love," and at the time people thought that was really naff, and now.
Now it sounds really naff.
It does sound really naff, it's kind of Love Actually, Notting Hill, Four Weddings kind of thing, that those things happen all the time.
Yeah, compared to that, it looks like Tartovsky.
Yes, it
looks like Nil by Mouth compared to.
But Jeff Goldblum's great in it, and Jeff Goldblum's, you know, obviously become a bit of a sort of cult hero recently, hasn't he? You know, to the younger generation. So I think it's worth rediscovering.
Because
it.
He keeps popping up in Jurassic Park and saying, "Don't do any more dinosaurs."
Yeah, but he's got a really cool social media presence, and he's all kind of languid and dude-y looking, isn't he? And
So that's The Tall Guy, and it's not available anywhere. It's probably streaming, isn't it?
Yeah. It's worth seeking out. You know, the you'd be able to get a DVD of it on Amazon for £2 probably, and it's well worth it.
Sean, what's your flop that shouldn't have flopped?
Well, it's Nightcrawler, which only came out in 2014, as has Jake Gyllenhaal in it. The premise, he's a petty thief, and he realises that you can make an awful lot of money if you start filming disaster scenes and selling them to the news networks and the rolling news networks. And it's about his descent into being someone who purely gives news footage for money and gets closer and closer into really quite disturbing scenes. Yeah. I mean, really horrible situation.
I really like Nightcrawler.
It's amazing. And I watched it. And it's one of those films where, you know, you're sort of paying attention and then your eyes widen. It just goes so far. And it shows, as I say, it's the descent of man, really. And it's about rolling news. It's incredibly critical of the media, which is why I think it was nominated for a few things. But there was a general quietness about it.
Yeah.
That we can't really give any plaudits as a thing that's really criticising what we're doing. Even in the film world, feeling it's very different from the TV world. They do mesh together. And it's fantastic. And I've never seen a film like it. I've never seen a film that deals with the amorality, actually the no morality, of people who, A, report on the news, who film the footage, not just, you know, these freelancers, but also the people who do it for a living, who get really desensitised to
it.
And it's about being desensitised to violence.
And Jake Gyllenhaal's brilliant, isn't he? He looks
amazing.
More haunted with it.
He kind of gets skinnier and skinnier,
and his hair gets slicked back and his eyes get more kind of like mental.
So
and he just looks like he's kind of consuming him from the inside.
And you can't stop looking at him. You can't stop looking at this emaciated figure who is just going downhill.
Yeah.
But he's also getting richer and richer and getting more and more successful. And yeah, so it's fascinating to watch.
What was the magnitude of its flop?
The magnitude was that people went to see it. It got the nominations, but it's been completely forgotten about. Mm. You can't get it streaming because I tried to rewatch it. I'm sure it's an Amazon £2 DVD. Mm. But it's not mentioned. It's just one of those things. Did that film exist? Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's still there. I thought it was amazing. I thought it should have got everything ongoing. And then suddenly no one talked about it. I said, have you seen Nightcrawler? Have you seen that? You know, to people, when we're talking about good films, no one I know has seen it apart from me.
Well, inevitably, like a lot of people, I thought it was a Marvel movie. Like, I thought The Iron Lady was a
Marvel
movie.
There's an X-Man called Nightcrawler, isn't there?
Yeah.
And there's that great sort of, is there a 90s house hit called By the Nightcrawlers?
By the Nightcrawlers, yeah.
The Nightcrawlers.
Maybe it suffered because of
the Nightcrawlers.
Well, mine, you'll be unsurprised to learn, I've got two. First up, obviously, Dredd. The Alex Garland adaptation of Judge Dredd that came out in 2012. It's fantastic. It's bloody. It's clever. It's brutal. It's like no subtext. It's like a full-on punk rock song. And it bombed, particularly in America. I think it cost $50 million to make and took $50 million and $45 million take, because it couldn't get out from under the shadow of the terrible Sylvester Stallone Judge Dredd movie that came out in 1996. So people were still wondering, why are you making a sequel to this awful movie? It's not a sequel at all. It's a complete different reboot, different take entirely. Carl Urban's incredible as Dredd. Never takes his helmet off, which is a huge problem for standard Hollywood marketing. But it's both faithful to what makes the comic so amazing and not faithful where it shouldn't be. So its vision of Mega City 1 is not this soaring futuristic spires. It's gritty. It's falling down. It's on the edge of collapse. And I just thought it's absolutely incredible. Was a catastrophe, was a disaster. But there's this ongoing talk that it can be turned into a Netflix series or it can be turned into an Amazon series.
Another moody superhero.
Well, here's the thing, though. The problem with the moody superhero ones is they tend to take something from the comic books that might be quite brightly coloured, might be quite exciting, might be quite, you know, psychedelic, and then they grim it up, they grim dark it to death, and you know everybody's got a psychological problem and so forth, which is not what makes the comic books great, and certainly not what makes the comic book movies great. Things like Thor, Ragnarok, and Black Panther, these are primary multicolored big psychedelic experiences, but Dread, that is that world, that is that original world, but also in it, it has shafts of humour and stupidity and silliness, like the fatties who require skateboards to under their fat bellies to get around town, and people covering themselves in expanding plastic called Boeing so they can bounce their way to work. It's got that stuff in it, so I think there's a capacity there to do something. And I think it's one of those cases where a flop movie still gets traction on DVD to the extent that you, at least its reputation is restored. It might make all the money back. You'll probably never see another Hollywood big screen version, but you might see it in another incarnation.
Like Buffy,
exactly. They should Buffyize it. My other choice, and this is one that everybody loathed, was John Carter, the adaptation of Edgar Rice Burroughs' John Carter of Mars series, which is the source material for Star Wars, the source material for a million fantasy epics.
What year is it?
This is 2012, 2013
okay.
as well.
I've not heard of it.
Legendarily catastrophic. The chairman of Disney resigned as a result. Lost $200
Mickey
million.
Mouse resigned?
Mickey Mouse. Mickey Mouse.
Bambi. What happened to Bambi, though?
Minnie divorced Mickey Mouse because of this. Kicked him out. He's living in a car as a result.
So, sleeping in the Jag.
Yeah, so what you have is a series of you know, the original source material, Edgar Rice Burroughs' fantasy movies, where a American Civil War soldier, or person from that era rather, falls asleep and finds themselves on Mars in a sword and sorcery epic with political undertones and a real sort of real sense of depth and texture. Catastrophically marketed. Firstly, they don't call it John Carter of Mars because apparently Mars is a turn-off word, we're told in the movies. You know, we're all from a magazine background and we were always told never put green on your cover because green is never seen.
Yeah.
Nobody knows who came up with this particular, you know, item of wisdom. Apparently there's an item of wisdom in Hollywood. Mm. Never put Mars in the title of your movie. It always flops. Mars Attacks apparently flopped. Mars Need Bombs apparently flopped. So they go out with this sword and sorcery Martian epic and they call it John Carter.
Yeah. It's right.
It sounds like it's about a lawyer.
I'm slightly obsessed with films with really boring titles.
Yeah.
And there's been a raft of them recently. John Carter, John Wick, which I quite like those John Wick films. But they've got the dullest titles in the world. It's just like a really dull man's name.
Sounds like a solicitor.
Like a dentist. Or there's ones now called The Commuter, the new film. Who wants to go and see The Commuter?
Well, to be honest with
you, I get enough of that on my commute.
I wouldn't want to go and see that if it was called Killing People on a Train, because it looked rotten. It absolutely stinks. Yeah.
And there's The Accountant was out. This is like,
oh, God, really?
What's going on?
Yeah. The Plumber. I would
managerial.
I would go and see a film called The Dentist. Or Cleaning the Kitchen Floor with Sean. That's blood and gutter. So, but you know, John Carter lost $200 million. Apparently the British taxpayer reimbursed 30 million quid to this through a tax scheme. So we're on the hook for it as well. And yet, I went to pity watch this movie in the last week that it was out. I was the only person in the cinema. When you see it, it is actually quite good. Mark Strong's in it. Taylor Kitsch is in it. He's terrible. Effects are good. Story has got, you know, decent subtext to it. It's worthwhile. So
worthwhile.
It's a flop worth bothering with, I'd say. Yeah. I wouldn't necessarily say $200 million well spent, but it is decent. And it hasn't, sadly. It hasn't got a cult afterlife at all. Nobody cares. So my heart goes out to it. And as our ears ring to the sound of the lovely eggs, the clock is ticking down to closing time chatter, where Sean and Michael will tell us what they'll be discussing as the warm pints of Carlsberg are snatched out of their hands at their local indie rock hellhole. Michael, what's your closing time chatter?
Well, I've been writing a piece the last couple of days about unseen TV characters based on... do you watch This Country, the brilliant BBC Three kind of rural mockumentary sitcom?
No.
Okay, it's like The Office, but in the Cotswolds. And there's this brilliant, one of the main characters has this sort of really shouty, sweary mum who you never see, just hear her yelling down the stairs and through doors, which is brilliant. So I've been thinking about other ones like that. So there's Elizabeth Mannering in Dad's Army, who's often talked about, you never see. Her in Doors from Minder. Columbo's wife, Charlie from Charlie's Angels. So I was going to ask you if you guys
Maris
had any...
from Frasier.
Exactly.
You never see Maris, yes. And that is a real strength, isn't it? You absolutely need to imagine what she's like.
She's often referred to, but it never... If they cast her, it'd be disappointing, wouldn't it?
Oh, it'd be terrible. It'd be disaster. It's much better we don't see her.
Does the teacher in Peanuts count? Because she's only ever heard as a muted trumpet going... wah, 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 wah. Yes. You never
or
see
the lady in Tom and Jerry, the kind of who you ever see the legs of.
Yes.
Thomas?
Moderately racist, yes. God, who else?
But there's one in Seinfeld, apparently. Well, there's several in Seinfeld. They're all Kramer's got these imaginary friends, but there's one called Bob Sacamano, who he refers to all the time. There's Father Bigley from Father Ted, who's always referred to. And always in some freakish way, like, always got a mouth like a fish, always obsessed with lipstick, Father Bigley, like that, and you never see him.
Well, the one that sticks out, you'll be unsurprised, then again, from the comics, from the Fantastic Four, The Thing's Aunt Petunia.
Ah.
Aunt Petunia is always, it was for like about 40 years, but Aunt Petunia was always off screen as this imagined kind of terrifying Gorgon woman that even Ben Grimm, the Thing, the guy made of rocks, the immensely strong, the guy who can lay the Hulk out, is terrified of his Aunt Petunia that he grew up with in the Bronx or whatever. And then in around 1986 or something, John Byrne, the great comics artist John Byrne, was drawing the Fantastic Four, and he brings Aunt Petunia on and she's gorgeous. The whole running gag was that she was this terrifying Gorgon, and it turns out that she's, and of course, you know, you probably wouldn't do that now, what with today's sexual politics of the modern world, but it was just a nice little twist. Then somebody else went and killed her off screen. It was a terrible, bad idea. But that
ugly,
was
ugly
nice
naked one. Guy from Friends.
Ugly naked guy from Friends.
Yeah, but you don't want to see him.
No.
Oh, no.
You
Her Indoors, though. Her Indoors would be a really good name for a sitcom. And actually have the Her Indoors, who's just amazing.
There you go.
Yeah.
Sean, what's your closing time chatter?
Well, I've got a question. Has anyone got a Tibetan singing bowl? Because I really want to get one, but will I use it?
What is it?
My friend's got one, and I spent Saturday night just pinging it because it makes that meditation healing sound. But I thought that maybe, you know, we could have one in the big mouth thing. It just goes bong.
What's it for? Are you
supposed to sing along to it then, or is it just...
You can sing along to it. It can help heal you probably through vibes. You could probably make a load of records with it. I was awake all night because I was too cold, and I was thinking about Marquis Smith's ghost and a Tibetan singing bowl coming together and creating a new sort of sound. And so I really want to get one. I just wonder if anyone's got one, or you.
It was a long shot, but no.
No, they sell them in Kilburn in Folkies. So by next week, I am going to be really calm, and I'm going to have invented a new sort of
music. Is that the sort of shop that sells sort of dream catchers? Yeah.
I think it does, with a load of acoustic guitars.
I think I just put soup in mine.
My
closing
Super Bowl.
The Super Bowl. Excellent, amazing. My closing time chatter is just delightful news. Our sister show, Romaniacs, has been nominated for a Broadcasting Press Guild Award.
Hooray.
This is terribly exciting. We're up against John Ronson's Butterfly Effect, Romash Ragnathan's Hip Hop Saved My Life, and Ed Miliband's and Jeff Lloyd's podcast, Reasons to Be Cheerful.
I'm a judge on that.
Are you?
But not on that category, so there's no, you know, there can't be any corruption involved.
That sound is the tenor being dragged back across the desk. We're amazed to be nominated. We're the only independent podcast to be nominated in this. We haven't got any stars. We've just got Dorian, who comes on the podcast, and Ian Dunn, and the other guys. And it's just nice to be nominated. Well, on that bombshell, that's the end of the show. Thanks to Michael Hogan for coming in. What are you up to next, apart from writing about invisible TV stars?
Michael Caine. I interviewed Michael Caine last week. I've got to go and write it up.
Very nice.
Amazing. Mm. 85. Still got it.
This is his movie about life in London.
Yeah, which is surprisingly good.
Oh, right.
You know, I just damn it with faint praise. But he's made this documentary about sort of 60s London, kind of from his point of view, and it's... And they found loads of archive footage. And it's really, really good.
Brilliant. OK, well, thanks for coming in. Do come in again. Get well soon to Steve Yates, who was supposed to be here, but he's stricken with the lurgy. Thanks as ever to Sean and to Sophie Black for producing the show. We'll be back next week. Remember, if you've enjoyed this show, then you can find our past episodes at audioboom.com/channel/Big Mouth. If you have a moment, look up Big Mouth on Patreon and buy us that virtual pint to pay the bills. We'll be back next week with more quality pop talk. And, well, finally, I never get to choose a tune because we usually don't have time for it, but this week is an exception. Sometimes a track just pops up when you're least expecting it, and it's amazing. Here's one. This is Kolsch, which popped up on my phone. He's half Irish, half German, raised in Denmark, and putting out records on the Cologne label Compact. So how European Union does that get? This is gorgeous. It's from his album 1989. It came out last year. This track is called Cairo with a KH. This is Kolsch.